Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Is race becoming irrelevant in U.S. society? That was a dream of America's first Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. As the Harvard-educated son of an elite black family, Robert Clifton Weaver was raised to be both a credit to his own race and a defender of those members of it denied the opportunities that his family's wealth and stature had afforded him. Weaver worked hard to fulfill those expectations, believing he could strengthen civil rights by eliminating housing discrimination. But he also worked relatively quietly and within the system, which has meant that some of his contributions to equality have been less celebrated than many of his more outspoken peers. My guest today hopes to change that. Wendell E. Pritchett is professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania and director of the Office of Research, Planning, and Policy for the City of Philadelphia. His new book is called Robert Clifton Weaver and the American City, The Life and Times of an Urban Reformer. Wendell, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris.
So Weaver's light skin had been an advantage for him, as his wife's had been for her. In fact, she admitted that she wouldn't correct people who assumed that she was white. Weaver, on the other hand, was adamant that he would live as an African-American. Can you talk about that?
Yes, that's true. And Weaver, in fact, there's an interesting family myth, which I actually wasn't able to completely confirm, but the myth was that his grandmother was actually the daughter of two white Americans, that she was the daughter of an illicit liaison. And as a result, her parents sent her to Arizona with her black nanny. When they came back, the nanny said that the baby was hers. And this was Weaver's grandmother. So if this is true, which again, I wasn't completely able to document, then, you know, his grandmother, his maternal grandmother was white. Weaver, though, on the other hand, thought that being clear that he was an African-American was very important. And he did explain that to his wife when they got married, that he felt that they should be consider themselves African-Americans. In the long run, I do think that his skin color had an impact on his ability to work within elite America, certainly that he was viewed more as more similar to the people he was working with than different.
Yeah, when he was a kid, his mother would advise him to escape the brutalities of discrimination by basically just excelling at whatever he did. That seems like a lot of pressure to put on a young person, but clearly he grew up learning to cope with stress.
Yeah, well, the world that he grew up in, most of his friends had mothers like his mother, and they were expected to excel, and that was how they were going to fight racism. And so that was not unusual for the milieu in which he grew up. But clearly, he felt a lot of pressure to succeed, and he felt a lot of pressure from his parents and his extended family to be successful, and it drove him throughout his life.
Yeah, Weaver's story is a great one to hear as an American, simply because we don't hear very much about elite black families, you know, especially at the turn of the 20th century. He was born in 1907, but his family had been educated and successful for decades. His grandfather graduated from Harvard.
Yes, he was the first African-American to graduate from Harvard. There were three that year, and he graduated from the dental school in the 1870s.
Then when Weaver himself was at Harvard, race was an obstacle in some ways. He was not allowed to live in the dorms with white students.
No, he wasn't, though. That was also, it provided both, you know, problems for him and a benefit because his roommates were really some of the most accomplished people of the 20th century. Ralph Bunche was his roommate, who later won the Nobel Peace Prize for his work in the Middle East. William Hasty, who became the first black federal judge, was his roommate. A person named John P. Davis, who's a little less well-known but was very active in leftist circles in the 1930s and 1940s, was also his roommate. And a lot of other people who were very active leaders of the civil rights movement were people that he interacted with, though, as you said, he was excluded from the dorms by a policy that had only been recently established at Harvard. Before he arrived there, in fact, African-Americans had lived in the dorms, and it was in the 1920s that the university took this new policy.
And it doesn't sound like you found evidence that it was the students who pushed for this.
No, there really wasn't evidence that the students had pushed for it. It was the administration that thought that there would be problems if there wasn't this kind of segregation. And in fact, there was a lot of protest against the new policy of segregation, but the administration held to it for at least a couple of decades.
How did Weaver get along socially? Did his white classmates come to his defense in other areas?
So I think that Weaver really Weaver was a shy person in general and somewhat of a loner, so he didn't have a lot of good friends, and I don't think that he tried to make a big deal of this, and I think he probably, if anybody said that they wanted to protest in favor of him, asked them not to. So there really wasn't much advocacy on his behalf. I think that he just kind of accepted that this was part of the system of the time, and he was going to, as you said, excel and prove people wrong in that way. And again, he had good friends. Actually, his brother was his roommate for his first year at Harvard. His brother was getting a master's at Harvard at the time. So he was comfortable in his situation, even though he was upset about the discrimination.
Is it too much of a leap to say that the Harvard experience with the dorms sparked his interest in fair housing issues?
Yeah, I think it's somewhat of a leap because he was I think the focus on fair housing really did start a little bit later, and it was in the context of post-war urban development. In the period before the World War II, there were relatively stable black middle-class communities, and while people wanted to have different options, I don't think they were as worried about housing discrimination as they were worried about other things, racist violence and job discrimination and things like that. It was really in the context of the post-war suburban housing boom that Weaver and a lot of other people got much more interested in fair housing activities.
The first public housing projects, I guess, started going up in the late 40s, and they were racially integrated to begin with. Why did they change so quickly?
Well, in northern cities, many of the facilities were integrated. In almost every southern city, they were segregated from the beginning. Even in the north, different cities took different approaches, and Weaver spent a lot of time in the 1940s fighting against discrimination and segregation in public housing, particularly in the north. For example, in New York City, almost all of the projects were either white or black from the beginning. Now, there were exceptions in New York, and there were many cities where other cities where they weren't segregated. But to answer your question, what happened over time, particularly in the 1950s, is that as other housing opportunities opened for whites and they didn't open for blacks, public housing was relatively decent housing. It's hard for us to conceive of that now, but in fact, public housing was really something that was sought after by a lot of people. And so because it was the only housing they could secure, many African Americans were turned to public housing, and over time it became much more segregated because of that phenomenon.
Weaver spent so much of his career advocating for lower-income Americans, and African-Americans in particular. But, as you write, he had a lot more in common with the Kennedy set of his day. What was the source, do you think, of his empathy for the less fortunate?
Well, I think that came from his upbringing. Certainly his parents told him that he had an obligation to help his race and to help people who were less fortunate in general. He had lots of peers who were also active in civil rights and anti-poverty causes. So there were lots of things pushing him in that direction. In addition, his first experience as a professional was in the New Deal. And, certainly Franklin Roosevelt's, main goal, obviously, was to bring the country out of the Depression, but, in that context, to help bring people out of poverty. And so, his early experiences were all involved in those areas. And so this was something that, he began his career with, and he followed through this whole life.
Yeah, he was an advisor to Harold Ickes, and I guess these days we need to say the first Harold Ickes, in something that was informally called the Black Cabinet. Would you tell us about that group?
Yeah, so his title, and this was not informal, his title was the Negro Advisor. It just always fascinates me that was his title.
It kind of makes you cringe now to even hear that.
Yeah, but that was his written title. He had business cards that said the Negro Advisor. And during his years in the New Deal, he was joined by a small but relatively influential number of other African Americans who also often had the title of Negro Advisor to some commission head or agency head. And so together they formed what was called they didn't actually call it that. Other people called it the Black Cabinet, the point being that these were leading officials in the New Deal administration that were focused on supporting the interests of African Americans and other people of color. And they would talk amongst themselves about and share information so that they could, have more success in improving race relations within the government and decreasing discrimination. A couple of the very other active people were a woman named Mary McLeod Bethune, who was a close friend and advisor of Eleanor Roosevelt, and again, William Hastie, who I mentioned was the first federal judge.
And so these individuals were definitely given afforded places of respect. They were not there as tokens.
Some of them were more tokens than others, but almost all of them were very intelligent and resourceful people. So even when their bosses might have viewed them as tokens, they were often successful at getting things changed. Sometimes they did it directly by working with their bosses. In fact, Harold Ickes was pretty supportive of civil rights. So Weaver had a lot of support. But other members of the Black Cabinet had to use, you know, more surreptitious methods to achieve some of their goals. So some of them were viewed as tokens, even though, again, many of them were very successful.
Wendell E. Pritchett is my guest. He's professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania. His new book is called Robert Clifton Weaver and the American City, The Life and Times of an Urban Reformer. One of the things that Weaver did was work with the NAACP to monitor the impact of the New Deal on African Americans. Can you talk about his conclusions?
This was one of the examples where he really was caught between two worlds, because Weaver's conclusions in general were positive. His conclusions were often that there's been a lot of discrimination, but we're making a lot of progress. We're getting resources for African Americans. We're getting jobs for African Americans, public housing and things like that. We're making a lot of progress. At the same time, if you were poor African American, you didn't always see that progress. And there were often people in organizations like the NAACP who were rightly concerned about continued discrimination. So as a person who was on the inside, he often talked about the glass being half full. He didn't at all deny that there were lots of problems, but he did want to highlight some of the successes. And often that put him in a position of conflict with other civil rights activists who really, you know, wanted to remind people of all of the continuing obstacles and racism within the government.
He was not really a fan of grassroots efforts for change. He really thought that the government was in the best position to do things. And did that also sort of put him at cross purposes with people who were trying to make a difference?
I think so. Now, you know, that was partly just his upbringing. You know, he, again, grew up in this relatively elite culture. You didn't, you know, stage protests. You didn't shout. You did things quietly, and you made progress in that fashion. So it was his personality. He also felt, and this was not unusual for, you know, people, liberals of his time, he felt that government was really the most efficient way to make progress. And so, you know, that was not a color issue. There were many white officials who felt the same way. And there were obviously lots of disputes between grassroots activists and government officials, liberal officials, both of people of color and white people. So this tension was not unusual. One of the things I write about in the book is that, you know, he and other leaders were often blind to some of the negative impacts of some of their policies. One example I talk about frequently is the Urban Renewal Program, which in theory was a good idea, but the impact of some of the urban renewal policies was to uproot the people, specific people who were supposed to be helped. And because they were not really engaging with those communities, Weaver and some of his colleagues were kind of blind to those problems.
Well, and I guess they were doing all this for the first time really in history. Many of these programs were unprecedented anywhere.
Yeah, almost all of them were unprecedented. And, you know, the New Deal was an experimental effort. And one of the many positive aspects of President Roosevelt and his staff was that they were willing to admit when they made a mistake, often. So, you know, they try something. If it didn't work, they try something else. It's not a surprise that some of these efforts didn't work exactly the way they were planned, and often they did try to take other approaches. In the example of public housing and urban renewal, however, these were pretty long-standing programs, and by the 1960s, a lot of the criticisms of the programs were becoming really evident.
Wendell E. Pritchett is my guest. He's director of the Office of Research, Planning, and Policy for the City of Philadelphia, and he teaches law at the University of Pennsylvania. His new book is called Robert Clifton Weaver and the American City, The Life and Times of an Urban Reformer. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, and history start weekly, a part of SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Wendell E. Pritchett. His new book is called Robert Clifton Weaver and the American City, The Life and Times of an Urban Reformer. You can join our conversation by sending an email to think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. Let's talk, moving into the Kennedy years now. The chapter is entitled, The Kennedy Years, A Reluctant New Frontier. You point out the fact that, John F. Kennedy, despite the way people sort of remember him now, didn't make race a major issue in his campaign.
No, he really wasn't that interested and very much aware, really, of the civil rights movement or some of the problems facing African Americans. And in fact, I mean, his advisors argued to him that, given the limited victory that he won in 1960, that he really couldn't focus on civil rights and really should be focused on other matters.
So he brought Pritchett in, though. He brought Weaver in to run what would become HUD later on under the Johnson administration.
Yes. So he was under pressure. In fact, he had made a commitment to many civil rights leaders that he was going to have African Americans in his administration. And so that was why he chose Weaver. It was a little bit of a surprise to some people. At the time, Weaver was actually the chairman of the board of the NAACP. So he was certainly known among African Americans, but I don't think that many people thought of Weaver as a political person. So some people were somewhat surprised. And then, of course, there was the inevitable opposition by Southern segregationists to African American, particularly one who was so closely allied with the civil rights movement. And in fact, his the nomination process was fairly painful for Weaver. He was approved in the end, but it was not an easy process.
You say people didn't think of him as a political figure. Was the NAACP political in a different way in the late 50s and early 60s?
Well, no, I think that the NAACP was political in the sense that it wanted to support public officials who were pro-civil rights, but it wasn't involved in campaigns. Right. In fact, it couldn't be involved in campaigns. And Weaver himself, even though he was friendly with lots of Democratic politicians, was not a political activist himself.
So when he got in there, how much influence did he have on President Kennedy and his ideas?
Not very much. He really didn't have that much influence. So with one exception, in 1961, one of the first acts that Kennedy was able to pass was the Housing Act of 1961, which created some relatively positive programs for housing. And Weaver helped lead that effort. So he did gain some respect within the Kennedy administration. But after that, for the next 2.5 years, Weaver really struggled to get any attention from the White House. He really didn't.
Yeah, and there continued to be arguments between Weaver and other people in positions of power as to whether or not you could legislate integration.
Yes. And Weaver's position was, no, you can't legislate integration, but you can legislate removing barriers to people that allow them to move where they want to or achieve, you know, education or go get a good job. You know, that was really what he was focused on, was removing barriers, not specifically promoting integration. But even in the context of that period, even removing barriers was often viewed with a lot of suspicion. And so, you know, the big fight that he had with the Kennedy administration was to try to get them to issue an executive order banning discrimination, again, not promoting integration, but just banning discrimination in federal housing programs. Kennedy had promised during the campaign that he would sign the order, and he had actually chided President Eisenhower for not doing it. But then after Kennedy got elected, it took him over 2 years to actually sign the order.
I wonder if we can step back for a minute here and talk a little bit about Weaver's style in working with different groups of people and trying to get done the things that he thought were really necessary in this country. Because he was, in many ways, a low-key figure, especially in light of how much power he did have, ultimately.
He was very much an academic. He liked to spend a lot of time doing analysis, thinking through a problem, talking to lots of people about it. He liked to build a case. He would have made a good lawyer. He liked to build a case very carefully and show why his position was the right one. He wasn't a person who went to the media to complain. You know, he didn't talk behind the backs of his superiors or people that he worked with. You know, he really was somebody who wanted to work through the system, and he felt that this was the best way to achieve success. And, you know, I mean, the results do speak for themselves. He did achieve success, but it was a slow process.
Yeah, you talk about him liking to use science. He wanted research to back up whatever idea he was going to present.
Yeah, and again, he really was a social scientist, and you know, he wanted detailed research. You know, he really pushed his people to be able to prove all of the points that he was making. He didn't go out on a limb and make assertions that he didn't feel that he could really back up.
So in the eyes of Lyndon Baines Johnson, that made him a relatively unimpressive figure.
You know, he and Johnson, President Johnson, had a complicated relationship because I think, and it comes out in a lot of the White House tapes that Johnson recorded, Johnson genuinely liked Weaver. He thought he was a good person. He genuinely liked him, but he wasn't impressed. He didn't feel that Weaver was a dynamic person. That was the word that he kept on using. And, you know, Johnson was a larger-than-life person, and he did like people to have big personalities. So, you know, of course, he didn't want anybody to be bigger in the room than him. So there was always that contrast. And I think Weaver actually kind of felt that he, you know, shouldn't be competition. So that was one of the reasons why he was more quiet. But Johnson really did think that Weaver wasn't dynamic enough to really make the impact, even though in the end he did appoint him the HUD secretary.
Yeah, and for a while, Johnson thought the only person who could be effective for African-Americans in that position would be a white person.
Yeah, again, the tapes, which are available online, by the way, at the Lyndon Johnson Archives, and they really are fascinating. You know, Johnson recorded his phone conversations with almost everybody, and so there are conversations with Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy and lots of other people. And he spent a lot of time in the 4 months between the creation of HUD and Weaver's appointment talking to people about whether he should appoint Weaver. And he kept on saying the phrase, I mean, I think after hearing him saying to 10 different people, it was clearly a stock phrase that he thought that a white man could help the Negro in the cities more than a Negro could help themselves. My conclusion about that whole period was that, in fact, Johnson knew he was going to appoint Weaver, but he really wanted everybody to beg him to appoint Weaver before he actually did it so that they would all owe him. But this was clearly something he talked about a lot.
Meanwhile, this was a horrible time for Weaver, sort of knowing he was the most qualified person anywhere within the government or anywhere else in the country. But he wasn't sort of tipped off by Johnson that this was coming. He had to sit there and agonize.
Yeah, he was in agony. Now, it was even worse for Weaver because, in fact, Kennedy, there had been an aborted effort to create a Department of Urban Affairs under President Kennedy. And Kennedy had said publicly, nationally, that he would appoint Weaver that job. And the Senate, for a bunch of reasons, including the fact that Weaver was going to be the appointee, voted that department down. So many people expected when HUD was created that Johnson would, of course, appoint Weaver HUD secretary. So it was very painful for Weaver. And in fact, he wrote Johnson a resignation letter late in this period. And what's interesting is that Johnson's aides thought that Johnson would accept it. Would accept the resignation letter. And then when he got it, Johnson said, no, you tell him to stay there. And so they had to go back to Weaver and say, no, the president doesn't want you to resign, after they had kind of gave him the impression that the president did want him to resign.
And his wife was the one who said, just stick it out and wait till you hear an answer one way or another.
Yeah, she did. She stuck by him, and they were married for over 50 years, and that was kind of the story of their life in general. She was just supportive of him in everything. She's an interesting person in and of herself. She had a PhD herself in speech and had a very active career as a teacher also.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest this hour is Wendell E. Pritchett. He's professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania and director of the Office of Research, Planning, and Policy for the City of Philadelphia. You can also email us this afternoon to think@kera.org. Mark from Garland writes, can you discuss Weaver's relationships with Dr. Martin Luther King and with Malcolm X?
So Weaver had not a very strong relationship with Martin Luther King. He really was active in government issues, and Martin Luther King was, you know, obviously a much more grassroots leader. So they knew each other, but not well. One interesting tidbit, in 1965, Weaver is appointed in 1966. In early 1965, Martin Luther King and President Johnson had a conversation where Martin Luther King said that he hoped that Weaver would get consideration, would get appointment as the HUD secretary when HUD was created. And Johnson said, yeah, I think I would do that. He said he compared it to when a pastor retires and the assistant pastor who really deserves the job, you know, you shouldn't pass them over. Martin Luther King didn't know Weaver and was a promoter of his, and certainly Robert Weaver had the utmost respect for Martin Luther King, but they didn't have a lot of interaction. With regard to Malcolm X, Weaver really was a fairly conservative elite. He didn't believe in the Malcolm X's approach to questions of grassroots organizing or black power. He was fairly conservative, so he did not have a relationship with Malcolm X.
Do you think that Weaver's reluctance to get involved in any kind of radical political activity is part of the reason that few people remember his name today in the way that they remember a lot of other leaders around that time?
Yes, I do. Now, it's more than that. You know, government officials don't tend to get a lot of attention in and of themselves. You have to have done, in general, something more public. But I think it also is the fact that he did not take those kind of positions that got you a lot of attention. Right? And so that I think that is one of the reasons why he hasn't gotten much attention.
Can you talk about what kinds of discrimination were legal before the Civil Rights Act, particularly with regard to housing?
So there are three very important civil rights acts that are passed during the 60s. The Civil Rights Act of 1964 banned discrimination in employment. The Voting Rights Act of 1965 banned discrimination in the political sphere. And the Civil Rights Act of 1968, which is really the Fair Housing Act, banned discrimination in housing. Now, there are other civil rights acts and other aspects of those acts, but those are really the three most important parts.
So how much influence did Weaver have on the kind of policies that the Johnson administration pushed for?
He had a fair amount of influence, both in terms of policies towards cities and policies towards civil rights. He was active in both those areas. So he really was the leader of the effort to pass the Fair Housing Act of 1968. He was also the leader of the effort to create the Model Cities Program, which was created in 1966. And finally, he was the leader of the effort to pass the Housing Act of 1968, which created a lot of programs that produced substantial amounts of affordable housing in the 1970s and 1980s.
You write that his goal was to make race irrelevant, and instead white and black Americans looked to him to mediate between the races. How did he find himself in that position?
Well, I think he found himself in that position because white elites felt comfortable with him. You know, he went to Harvard, he had the pedigree, he was reserved and, you know, not a rabble-rouser. So, you know, in some sense, he was chosen by white elites to represent African Americans, but also he came out of the black elite, which also appointed itself to represent the interests of African Americans, particularly in the first half of the 20th century. And that became more complicated as the civil rights movement went on. But, you know, he really was a mediator because he was a representative of black leadership, and white elites felt comfortable with him.
What do you think, Wendell, is the reason that he was so convinced that having black and white Americans and Americans of all races sort of living next door to one another was the solution for our problems with race?
Well, I actually think Weaver had conflicted opinions about that. He clearly felt that everybody should have the opportunity to live where they want. Right. Particularly, and this is something he talked about a lot, if they have the means, they should be able to purchase a house. He often said that, if they have the means, which, you know, obviously, if you don't have the means, then you're limited in your options. But one of the things that he focused on, particularly in the 1950s, was helping middle class African Americans, which was a growing group, get access to the suburbs. And I do think he felt, and particularly other leaders of the Fair Housing Movement, felt that when middle class African Americans were allowed to participate in suburban society, that white Americans would see that they really weren't that different, that the African Americans and white Americans had the same dreams and aspirations. And their hope was, from that acknowledgement, then racial barriers in other areas among working class people would also subside. I do think there were some flaws in that argument. In fact, we did see the racial barriers of wealthier people, racial barriers subside for wealthier people, but we haven't seen or for a much longer time see that trickle down, in fact, to poorer people.
What sort of neighborhood did he live in himself?
He lived on the Upper West Side of New York during the 50s when he was working for Governor Averill Harriman and had some other jobs. When he moved back to Washington in 1961, he lived in the Cleveland Park section, which is a upper middle class section that's in Northwest. And then when he moved back to New York in the 1970s, he also lived on the Upper East Side.
He and his wife did have one son who had a really hard time. Was that a factor, as far as you could see at all, of his father's work or of his race, or was he just a troubled kid?
I really struggled, to be honest with you, to piece together that story. These were people who were very reticent to talk about their feelings, to talk about their personal lives. And so there were parts of Weaver's story that I didn't get completely. But his son, who actually was adopted, did have a troubled youth, not too unusual. He was arrested for, he stole a bike one time. I mean, it wasn't, he wasn't a violent criminal, but he did have a troubled youth. And I never really got a sense of Weaver's connection to his son. When he was 22, he died in a gun incident. The family said that he was playing Russian roulette and shot himself accidentally. Most of the people that I talked to and the research that I did, I concluded that he had committed suicide. But this is something that's obviously very difficult to document for certain.
And I guess, although he, by all accounts, loved his son, it was sort of a factor of Weaver's personality that he picked up right after that happened and went right back to work.
Yeah, the day after the funeral, he went right back to work. And in fact, the executive order banning discrimination in housing that I talked about earlier that Kennedy finally issued was issued the week after his son died. And he was right next to Kennedy when that was signed.
So he was out of HUD once the Johnson administration was, or he was there for 2 years with Johnson.
Almost three.
Okay. And then what happened with his career after that?
He became the president of Baruch College in New York City. Baruch College is part of the City University of New York system. And interestingly, I taught there for 5 years myself. And it's a wonderful part of the system. He was president there for a little bit more than a year. They had some budget issues, and he resigned in protest, and then he became a distinguished professor at Hunter College, which is also a part of the City of New York University system, and he was there until he passed away in the late 90s.
Wendell E. Pritchett is my guest. He's professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania and director of the Office of Research, Planning, and Policy for the City of Philadelphia. We're talking about his new book, Robert Clifton Weaver and the American City, The Life and Times of an Urban Reformer. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, and history start weekly, a part of SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Professor of Law at the University of Pennsylvania, Wendell E. Pritchett. He's also Director of the Office of Research, Planning, and Policy for the City of Philadelphia. His new book is called Robert Clifton Weaver and the American City, The Life and Times of an Urban Reformer. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. One of the things he seems to have done is overestimated the power of urban planning and the ability of urban planning to solve a variety of social problems. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, and he wasn't alone in this, but in the post World War II era, planning was really viewed as the answer to a lot of problems, and the Urban Renewal Program is kind of the perfect example of this. The basic idea of the Urban Renewal Program was that you target areas in cities that are run down or blighted, you condemn them, and you replan them. And once you replan the areas, then they will be, happier places to live, less crime, less poverty, and those kinds of problems. There were several problems with this approach. First of all, many of the areas that they targeted were places where there was affordable housing and people could live, particularly African Americans. Once they tore down the housing, those people had nowhere to go. Or if they did go somewhere, they actually crowded into other areas and ended up making those areas more troubled. In addition, many of the things that they planned, the amenities or the types of developments were not particularly successful because people really didn't want those kinds of developments, subsidies. They didn't want high-rise development, or they didn't want large plazas or things like that. And so often these projects were not as successful as the planners thought they were going to be.
Something akin to that happened after Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans. Of course, no one meant for the hurricane to take place, but there's been a lot of criticism about the way that's been handled. Can you talk about how someone like Weaver would have looked at what's taken place following the destruction of so much low-income housing in the hurricane?
Yeah, there have been a lot of debates in New Orleans about, you know, building affordable housing, and you know, there are big questions about what kind of city New Orleans should be. Some people have been pushing for there to be new affordable housing, saying that, you know, the people that live down there are poor and really need new housing. Other people have used it as an opportunity to kind of disperse poor people by not building affordable housing, not rebuilding affordable housing. Weaver, I think, would have taken the approach that, you know, one, planning is a good thing, but in that system, you certainly need to provide for affordable housing, be aware of the fact that some people can't afford decent housing without government support, and also be aware of the fact that racial discrimination in housing still takes place, and so you have to create programs that take that into account. There are real difficulties in New Orleans, and I'm not sure that he would have been able to solve the profound problems that they have down there. But, you know, I do think that he was the kind of person who would focus on equitable development and providing for different kinds of people.
We've certainly come a long way in this country, and yet middle-class America is not racially integrated to the degree that somebody like Weaver might have hoped if he were to look out, you know, 40 years from when his government career ended. Can you talk about some of the reasons for that according to social science?
Well, there is a fair amount of social science on this, but it reaches different conclusions. Some social scientists have concluded that African Americans, like white Americans, would rather live in their own communities in general. And so we see places like Prince George's County outside of Washington, D.C., which is a middle-class community. It happens to be overwhelmingly black. There are other social scientists who argue that isn't the case, and in fact that there still remain underlying systems of discrimination that push middle-class African Americans to certain communities and keep them out of others. I think Weaver actually would conclude he was an optimist almost to the end. And I think he will conclude, in fact, that there has been a lot of progress. And if you look at indices of segregation, they have declined. They haven't declined as much as some people, including me, would like. But in fact, they have declined. And I think Weaver would point to the Fair Housing Act and other things that he was involved in as responsible for the positive changes.
How would you characterize his overall outlook on white racism? Did he sort of assume it was always an issue until he knew otherwise of white associates? Or because of his elitism, was he able to sort of associate with people who might have been less susceptible to those belief systems?
Well, because of his position, he was able to remove himself from some of the more virulent racism, you know, right? He wasn't subject to violent racism. The racism that he dealt with was, you know, much more passive and, you know, maybe opportunities that weren't offered to him because of his color. But in general, he was pretty optimistic and positive about his relationships with people. And I think that he concluded that, you know, if you work hard and try to do the best, that most people will see past color, at least on an individual basis, and that you can be successful. Now, you know, again, he started off with in a better position than most people of color, so it was easier for him to take that position. He did recognize that other people didn't have the advantages that he had, but in general, he was relatively optimistic about race relations in this country.
What's his legacy today?
Well, I think the biggest part of his legacy is that every day when you open the paper and look in the real estate section and you look at advertisements, particularly of big companies, in the corner, usually it's in the left-hand bottom corner, you'll see a house, and inside it'll say equal opportunity. That's because of the Fair Housing Act. So his legacy is in the newspaper and lots of other places every single day. The notice that discrimination, racial discrimination, and other kinds of discrimination in housing are illegal, and that they should be combated. Now, again, we haven't had all of the progress in promoting integration that we could have had, but we have had progress, and I think that's his biggest legacy.
We had an analyst on last week who was talking about the housing crisis and pointed at least some of the blame at the programs put forward starting in the Clinton administration to make sure that lower-income Americans, and in particular Americans of color, were given home mortgage loans sort of in the same percentages as people who are white. Sort of was able to factor out and find that in some cases there were reasons for these individuals being turned down for loans that had nothing to do with their color, that may have actually had to do with their stability and jobs. Do you accept that?
Well, there are two parts to this question. It is certainly true that in the last 5-10 years, people in this country who should not have received mortgages received them. There's absolutely no question about that. But it is false to say that the programs that were implemented during the Clinton administration are responsible for the bad lending that occurred, particularly in the last 6 or 7 years. In fact, most of the programs that were implemented in the Clinton administration, the foreclosure rates are still relatively low because they didn't say that you should loan to anybody. They said that we should have different kinds of tools for different kinds of people, and we have to acknowledge that if people have more troubled credit, then we have to have systems to make sure that they can continue to pay their mortgages. So, in fact, what I would argue is that the problem we've had right now is because we got away from those very carefully developed programs during the Clinton administration to a system where, yes, people were getting loans whether they deserved them or whether they could pay them or not. And that was not the intent of the programs in the Clinton administration.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Jason in Grand Prairie. Hi, Jason.
Hi, how are you today?
Fine, thank you.
Doing great. I love your show.
Thank you.
My question is, earlier you stated that there's an assumption that just like whites like to live in neighborhoods are predominantly white, that also blacks and other minorities tend to like to live in communities where there are other people like themselves. And I was wondering where this assumption came from, because I know at least the past decade, there have been numerous studies showing that minorities tend to live in other areas that are more diverse because of various political and socioeconomic reasons. And so I'm wondering where the assumption came from, why that assumption was used, and if a different assumption had been used, when we've had a different outcome regarding how we redevelop our neighborhoods and urban communities.
Thanks for your call.
Well, it is a great question. I think there's a debate among social scientists over this question, and I have to say that I find problematic some of the arguments that I was laying out, you know, that there's evidence that African Americans would choose to live among African Americans. I don't think that those arguments are very strong. I think you're right. In fact, there is also evidence that African Americans with the opportunity and the money tend to locate in racially diverse communities because they think they will get better resources there and there will be more opportunities for themselves and for their families. And I think that that's the goal that we should be pushing towards. The studies that I mentioned have looked at places, again, like Prince George's County outside of Washington, D.C., and reached the conclusion that maybe some African Americans choose this because there are middle-class communities in this country that which are fairly strongly segregated. So that's how they've reached that conclusion. I'm not arguing that that's, in fact, true.
How realistic do you think Weaver's dream of a society in which race was completely irrelevant is, even in 21st century America?
I think that we still have a long way to go if we're ever going to achieve that. I'm not sure that it's realistic. I don't think it's realistic to assume that race will not matter at all. I don't think we'll ever get to that point. And I don't think Weaver thought that we would get to that point. But I think, you know, he wanted to move on the path towards that goal. I do think that we've made significant progress in the last 10, 20 years in moving towards that goal. And of course, you know, we have an interesting presidential campaign going on that right now that supports that argument, at least at this point. We'll see how it plays out over the next couple of weeks.
Do you see parallels between the way that Barack Obama has run his campaign and the way that Robert Clifton Weaver tried to ensure housing equity?
Yes, I've obviously spent a lot of time thinking about this in the last few months. Weaver, again, wanted to push for programs where race didn't matter, right? So he was particularly focused on building affordable housing in general, eliminating barriers for African Americans and then letting the market work. And Senator Obama has spent a lot of time talking, instead of talking about things that divide us, talking about things that we all care about. We all care about health care, decent health care. We all care about good education systems. And I think his argument has been, in general, that we need to improve things for working class people in general. A byproduct of those changes will be that since there are many working class African Americans, working class African Americans will benefit probably disproportionately, but the programs aren't targeted towards African Americans and other people of color.
Let's go and take one more quick phone call from Matt in Fort Worth. Hi, Matt.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call, Chris. I had a question for your guest. Seems that there's been a push for equality for, you know, working class African Americans and whites to get mortgages. Is the tactic to just hand them out to get the percentage of African Americans and lower class citizens in general? Has there been a push for the? Are they just handing out the mortgages, or actually teaching, you know, folks that are less off to attain mortgages?
It's a good question. There have been criticism along the line of your guest last week of something called the Community Reinvestment Act, which was passed in 1977 and requires banks to provide loans without regard to race, you know, not discriminate, right? And some people have argued that the Community Reinvestment Act is also responsible for the mortgage problems, which is also just totally false, because the Community Reinvestment Act applies to banks, and banks have been under pressure for a couple of decades to provide more loans to people of color, and they have, in fact, increased them. But if you look at the mortgage crisis that we've had over the last few years, the mortgages which are in crisis are not from banks. They're from all of these other kinds of mortgage companies that aren't regulated in the same way. And so, in fact, if we had been regulating these other mortgage companies and saying things like, you can't just give out a mortgage, you know, willy-nilly, as you were saying, you have to actually have some income and proof that you're going to be able to take care of the house and those kinds of things, we wouldn't have gotten into the problems, or at least as deeply as we've gotten into the problems that we have today.
So how are things going in Philadelphia? What are you struggling with these days?
We're struggling with a lot of the same things that other people are struggling with. One of the interesting things for Philadelphia is that we don't have as severe a mortgage crisis today as, you know, other places around the country. Now, it's a glass half full and a glass half empty phenomenon. One of the reasons why we don't have a crisis today is because we've had a crisis for a lot of years. We have a lot of poor people in the city of Philadelphia, and unfortunately, every year there are thousands of families who can't pay their mortgage. The number hasn't increased that dramatically in Philadelphia in the last year. It's been too high for a long time. We have other problems that many other cities are struggling with. We have a violent crime rate that has been going down over the past year, but, you know, it's still way too high. We're worried about what the recession is going to mean for an economy that actually had been doing fairly well over the past decade. And we're not really sure how that's going to play out over the next year. We're certainly worried about a budget deficit for the city, because if the economy sours, then the revenues that we were hoping for are not going to be there. So, you know, we're like a lot of other places.
Sounds like you're a lot like North Texas as well. Wendell, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you, Chris.
Wendell E. Pritchett is professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania and director of the Office of Research Planning and Policy for the City of Philadelphia. His book is called Robert Clifton Weaver and the American City, The Life and Times of an Urban Reformer. My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.